Now we're reflecting on 50 years of Title IX on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, exploring the landmark gender equity law through the decades, what it's meant to you, Wisconsin, our nation. Here's one voice. In April, an all-female broadcast crew produced a UW softball game against Nebraska, and they noted the occasion in a video with former student athlete turned broadcaster Faith Kane, who called that game.
Just being able to be on that field, you know, that's what Title IX is all about, is being able to be that athlete and be out there and know that this time is so important for them. You know, this is their dream to play on a field like this.
That is courtesy of Big Ten Network. Join in on Title IX 800-642-1234. Judith Sweet is a consultant for Title IX and gender equity initiatives, served as the NCAA Senior Vice President for Championships and Education Services. In 1991, became the first female president of the NCAA. In 2009, inducted into the State of Wisconsin Athletics Hall of Fame. Judy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. Nice to be with you.
Good to be with you. So as you look at Title IX, can you describe what it has meant to our country, what it has meant to you in your career?
Well, first of all, it's important to note that Title IX wasn't created for athletics, although athletics has benefited the most. Title IX is really an education initiative. So it opened the door for girls and women to go to medical school, to go to law school, and have opportunities in athletics. And that's where it impacted my career. Never could I have anticipated when I was growing up that I would have had an opportunity to be an administrator in college athletics, because women weren't even participating in college athletics at that time. Nor were women participating in medical school the same numbers that they are today. At that time, maybe 5% of medical school enrollees were women. Now it's about 50%. In college athletics, it was probably 5 or 10% of programs that had something for women. More were recreation programs. Now the numbers have increased to about 43% of college athletes being women. But after 50 years, we really should be at equity. And unfortunately, we're not.
As you say there, Title IX was initially meant to address discrimination that women faced in law school, in grad school, med school. But when we think of it today, we really think of sports. We think of athletics. How did athletics, you know, really take center stage on this law?
I think athletics became most visible in respect to Title IX because the numbers were so bad. There were no athletic programs that were being offered at all. So when Title IX became law and universities realized that it was a federal law that they needed to comply with, there was the threat that if they didn't comply, they would lose federal funding. They started paying attention, and it's been a slow progress, but it has been progress. As I mentioned earlier, we're still not there. Hopefully, we don't have to wait another 50 years before we comply with the federal law. Let's just keep moving forward.
I'm going to reintroduce you here as we talk about the state of Title IX on the law's 50th anniversary. We have Wisconsin Athletic Hall of Famer Judy Sweet. From 75 to 99, served as Athletic Director of UC San Diego, first female to do so. You can join in on how you've seen the impact of Title IX through the years. 800-642-1234. Judy, I'm wondering, as you had your start playing badminton for UW-Madison way back when, your college experience in the late 60s, can you compare, contrast your athletic experience to what female athletes experience today?
The first thing to note, when I attended the University of Wisconsin, there was no athletics program for women. It was called the Women's Recreation Association.
Wow.
They didn't even use the word athletics pertaining to women. We had a budget for all of the recreation program for women that was $5,000 total. We had to do fundraising for any activities that we participated in, and those primarily were sports days, where you would go to another school and you would compete for one day, you'd have punch and cookies, and then you'd go home. It was nothing like the high level of competition that takes place today.
That just seems like light years away from where women's athletics is today. It doesn't seem possible almost.
Well, it's more like it was the dark ages for women's athletics. Unfortunately, that's what we experienced prior to Title IX.
When you became an athletic director, managing team budgets, managing scholarships, coaching salaries, how did you see the impact? Title IX being rather new even then, how did you go about creating fair budgets for men's and women's teams? What did that look like?
Interestingly, when I became athletic director and had an opportunity to look at the budgets, it became very clear to me that the women's athletics program in San Diego was being shortchanged. And when I became a decision maker, that made it possible for me to adjust the budgets. I came up with a formula that looked at the number of participants, the number of competitions, where the teams were actually competing, and made the budget equitable for both men and women. The whole idea behind Title IX is that we provide opportunities and support for both our sons and daughters that are equitable. If our sons would be willing to accept what our daughters have and our daughters accept what our sons have, that would be compliance with Title IX.
Sometimes when we view Title IX from the outside, we see a sport eliminated and they say, well, it was because of Title IX. We need to have a balance here. What is going on inside athletic departments when they are trying to weigh whether they can have a men's team or whether they need to make a women's team and looking at that balance?
The idea behind Title IX is to provide opportunities. There is nothing in Title IX that would suggest eliminating programs. Universities that choose to, underline the word choose, to eliminate a program are doing it because philosophically they believe that they need to do that. But in reality, what they should be doing is adding an opportunity for the underrepresented gender. And notice that I'm not saying underrepresented is women, because it's not always the case. In most cases, probably 98%, women are underrepresented. But if men were underrepresented, Title IX would protect them as well. So the schools that have eliminated men's programs, which typically has been what has happened, have blamed Title IX. And it's not Title IX. It's because they want to put more resources into other men's programs rather than putting more resources into women's programs.
Judy Sweet, former Badger, blazed trails for women's athletics at UC San Diego, first female to run both the men's and women's athletic programs there, turned sports executive, becoming first female president of the NCAA. Join in on what Title IX has meant to you, how you see it today, questions you have about it, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Judy Sweet on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. Today marks 50 years of Title IX, the groundbreaking civil rights law, as we explore its impact here on Wisconsin schools across the nation on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you can join in this conversation how you've seen Title IX impact in your life, whether it was going in grad school, whether it's been participating in a sport. The UW marked the anniversary with a video trailer. Here's a moment with Carla McLeod, a pioneer of women's hockey, inducted into the UW Athletic Hall of Fame in 2020.
We know there's still a gap, but I think many of us are pushing in the right direction. It's not just women pushing. It's all of us that enjoy sport.
Join in on your Title IX reflections, what the law has meant to your education, your career, 800-642-1234. Judy Sweet is a Title IX consultant, trailblazer at NCAA as its first female president and in the Wisconsin Athletic Hall of Fame. She's with us for about 9 more minutes. Judy, I want to ask you this because of your NCAA connections. Is there a difference between Title IX protections and NCAA rules on gender equity?
That's a really good question, Kate. Yes, there's a big difference. Title IX is a federal law, and all schools at the elementary, secondary, and higher education level are subject to a federal law. Gender equity is a definition that the NCAA created with the Gender Equity Task Force in 1993 when we realized that schools weren't complying with Title IX. The NCAA does not come under the federal law. And as a result, the NCAA has not imposed any rules that would require institutions to comply with Title IX, but the NCAA does advocate and have as a constitutional amendment that schools should be in compliance with gender equity.
Okay, so in terms of compliance or enforcement, or how then does the Department of Education, if at all, then interact with athletic departments through its Office of Civil Rights?
Another really good question. The Office of Civil Rights is more focused on correction than penalties. And I think I mentioned earlier that if a school's not in compliance with Title IX, it was subject to losing federal funding.
Mm-hmm.
That has never happened. If a school is not in compliance, it requires someone at that school or a parent to contact the Office of Civil Rights and file a complaint. The Office of Civil Rights then, hopefully, will follow up on that complaint and do an investigation of the school to determine if, in fact, they are in violation of Title IX. It would be rare for them to really penalize the school. It would be more, these are the steps you need to take to come in compliance with Title IX. Another direction that a school or an institution might be subjected to would be a lawsuit. If an individual feels that there's discrimination, an individual could file a lawsuit against that institution. And in almost every situation where a lawsuit has been filed, the courts have found in favor of the gender that has been discriminated against.
I'm going to reintroduce you here, Judy Sweet, talking about the state of Title IX, the intricacies of the law on the 50th anniversary, and hearing from you, 800-642-1234. Joe is joining us from Ontario, Wisconsin. Hi, Joe. What would you like to bring up?
Hi. I'm enjoying the conversation. Thanks for having it. So I think the big question is what is equity and how it's defined? You know, is it defined in terms of money per participant, number of participants in the total program? I coached at the high school Division III, Division II, Division I level. And the thing that I can't help but note is the major sports like basketball and football bring in huge amounts of money that benefit the minor sports. I was a swimmer in college. Our program existed because we had a great football team and there were plenty of monies that channeled through the athletic program. And sometimes when equity is trying to be accomplished, those major sports can suffer, and therefore the rest of the sports suffer. So it's a real difficult dilemma, and I'm wondering what your guest thinks about how to balance the major sports and their income generating power versus the minor sports that actually benefit from that.
I appreciate, Joe, you calling in. Judy, what do you think?
Joe, thanks for the question. I think it's important to clarify, first of all, for a participant, there's no such thing as a major and minor sport. So you're talking about sports that bring in money. Every sport brings in some amount of money. There are those that generate more than other sports, but they also spend a lot more. The important point is that Title IX doesn't care where the money comes from. Title IX is focused on making sure that female and male athletes benefit to the same degree. Your question in regards to what does that mean? Participation is based on three different prongs, one of which is the enrollment numbers, and then it's also dependent upon scholarships offered. But most important to most schools, particularly at the secondary level, is the laundry list, which consists of 11 different components, one of which could be uniforms. So are men and women getting new uniforms equitably? They don't have to spend the same amount of money because in different sports, they're more expensive. But the important thing is, are they getting the same degree of benefit? Are they getting supported to the same degree? Doesn't matter where the money comes from. Doesn't matter if you do fundraising. They need to be treated equitably.
Joe, thanks. Virginia now in Janesville. Virginia, hi, go ahead.
Hi, I appreciate this program. I'm learning a lot. I want to say nothing drops from heaven and is given to us. I know second wave feminists worked hard to get Title IX. I don't know their names. I don't know the history. I would like to acknowledge those women. So whatever you can tell me, I'm interested in the history.
Virginia, thank you.
I think it's really important to note that it was both men and women, but the women who were most influential were Congresswoman Edith Green and Patsy Mink, and a woman named Bernice Sandler. But I also think it's important to note the role of Senator Birchbeigh. He was a senator from Indiana. He's often referred to as the godfather of Title IX, in the same way Bernice Sandler is referred to as the godmother of Title IX. All of those individuals were very influential.
As we close, we have less than a minute left. What does Title IX have yet to accomplish in women's sports? What does the future hold?
Title IX is a federal law, and schools need to comply. And I hope it doesn't take 50 years more for that to happen. I'd like to see it happen within the next few years, that our sons and daughters are treated equitably.
When you say have yet to comply, what is that, you know, what is noncompliance looking like here? Where are the gaps?
From participation standpoints, women at the collegiate level are only receiving 43% of the participation opportunities, 43% of scholarship dollars, 40% of dollars spent on travel and uniforms, about 35% of money spent for recruiting. Those are all the 11 elements that need to be looked at where we need to come into compliance.
Judy, thank you for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Judy Sweet is a Title IX and gender equity consultant, previously served as the NCAA Senior Vice President for Championships and Education Services. We're going to continue this conversation on Title IX, hear from you at 800-642-1234. We'll have a victim rights attorney explaining her efforts to protect students from sexual harassment and gender discrimination under Title IX. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. On this Title IX anniversary, it is the morning show. I'm Kedar Chirkent. We're hearing your stories about the work of upholding the law that prohibits sex discrimination at educational institutions receiving federal funds. The publication Inside Higher Ed, they ran a piece yesterday on how recent regulatory changes have deterred victims from reporting, and changes made under the Trump administration in 2020 narrowed the cases that fall under Title IX. Join in what you see, 800-642-1234. Laura Dunn is a victim rights attorney. She founded a Washington, D.C. law firm to advance and enforce victims' rights for survivors of gender violence in campus, criminal, and civil legal systems. Laura, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me on.
How do you feel about the state of Title IX protections for sex-based discrimination and sexual harassment? What is the state of Title IX?
It's a great question. You know, so much progress has been made because of this young civil rights law, helping women get into higher ed, not just as students, but as employees, and really kind of transforming career opportunities for women, including in the area of sports. And so much has occurred in the last 50 years, but as you kind of signaled, there have been some challenges. Under the Trump administration, significant changes were made for Title IX proceedings in campuses, addressing most often sexual harassment and violence. And unfortunately, a lot of those changes favored those who are accused rather than protecting those who are victimized, which is the sole purpose of Title IX. So we are at this stage where we are grateful for all the progress made, but also holding our breath, waiting for the Biden administration to update Title IX regulations, not just to correct what has happened in the previous administration, but also to add protections for LGBTQ students, because that's the most recent kind of wave of Title IX protections. Sex discrimination is not just protecting women and girls, but also protecting those of different sexual orientations and gender identities.
And we're going to get into LGBTQ and fitting into Title IX in just a moment. But I just want to back up for a moment. Under the Trump administration, I believe in 2018, you sued Betsy DeVos, head of the Department of Education. What impact did you see the Trump administration making there to Title IX, and how has that impacted what you see today?
It's a great question. So definitely under the Trump administration, we saw the flipping of Title IX on its head. Rather than protecting those victimized, it was protecting those who were accused of committing that victimization. So through Serve Justice, the national nonprofit I ran at that time, we brought a lawsuit to try to stop and delay and hold the line for this important civil rights protection. And there has been so much that has happened since then, but unfortunately, we weren't able to kind of prevent many of those changes. And instead, we've had to live within a system that has altered fundamental protections for survivors on campuses. And as you've mentioned, deterred many survivors from coming forward, from speaking out, from accessing a legal process that could give them justice and make campuses safer. So there's much on the horizon with possible changes to Title IX regulation, but as an attorney, day in and day out, I've had to help my clients navigate a very challenging system after all those changes.
If I understand, it is Title IX coordinators who are responsible for compliance and complaint investigations on college campuses. Are these coordinators, sometimes one-person offices, able to handle the work and the complaints and upholding the law?
It's a great question. Title IX regulation requires there to be at minimum one person assigned as a Title IX coordinator to oversee both investigations and resolutions of these complaints, whether they be of sex discrimination, sexual harassment, or sexual violence. And while some schools can only afford one person, and that one person may not even full-time do Title IX, they may have other responsibilities, other schools have made entire offices, have hired investigators, have hired trainers, and really expanded and meaningfully sought to challenge the norm of sexual violence on campuses. So it is a challenging position, but it's an important one. And while colleges and universities have largely hired Title IX coordinators because of all the student advocacy done on Title IX over the years, K through 12 schools still don't always have Title IX coordinators. So there's much still to be done in improving campuses to even know what Title IX is, let alone implement it correctly.
I wonder what you think, practically speaking, needs to change about how universities investigate sexual harassment complaints, how they adjudicate, how these Title IX offices operate.
I think fundamentally they need to remember that sexual violence is wrong, that they don't want it on their campus, and that even though due process is meant to ensure that we don't get it wrong, that we never put someone out of a campus or suspend them for something they didn't do, that doesn't mean you give them the benefit of the doubt. You still aggressively investigate. You still pursue all leads. You talk to every witness. And the goal there is to, again, eradicate sexual violence from campus. That's literally the goal in the Title IX regulations. And I think there's been massive miscommunication and confusion among personnel on college campuses and K through 12 campuses to think that being neutral somehow means you don't care about eradicating sexual violence. We still need to have that over in making our campuses safe, because it's not just the one student who's victimized. It's actually all the students who saw and heard and learned about it that now feel unsafe, that feel like they could have that happen to them. And that culture, just, we need to eradicate it. It shouldn't exist. We should make it such that sexual violence is so rare rather than what it is now, which is still normative.
Talking on the 50th anniversary of Title IX, its protections, with Laura Dunn, victim rights attorney, works to advance and enforce victims' rights for survivors of gender violence on college campuses. 800-642-1234 to join in. Laura, I want to talk a bit about your connection to UW-Madison as a former student, a former rower. You, I understand, filed a sexual assault complaint against the university, and you reported being sexually assaulted by two male teammates. What was reporting the incident like?
Well, back then, there had not yet been a major movement to address campus sexual violence. When I reported, I barely knew what the system was. I had a professor stop her philosophy class and tell us that there was even a right to go report to the dean of students' office. I did not even know that much. And I remember right after that class, I went over to Bascom Hill, and I was so nervous. And I was standing in front of a student worker, and I was trying to figure out, how do I say this out loud? Like, I didn't even know how to get past square one, and I had to say that I was sexually assaulted, and of course started crying. I could tell that poor student worker was way overwhelmed and just like ran out to the dean of students. It was a very painful process. And while, you know, the first dean I spoke to was supportive, the process was not. I kind of got the message that it was fine for me to want help, to want support, to get safety measures, to get accommodations, but how dare I actually hold someone accountable, let alone two men from an athletic team? And I wish I could say, since my experience, that so much has changed at UW-Madison. In many ways, the process has improved. It's clearer. There's more transparency. There's advocacy offices. But I still think there's a fundamental failure to want to hold the individuals who commit these offenses, especially when they are male student athletes, accountable. That has not changed.
I wonder how that experience informed your law trajectory, your experience as an attorney.
In every way. No one was there for me at all. I didn't know who to ask, where to go, who could help. And it wasn't for lack of trying. There just wasn't a person. And I decided to become that person. I am now the attorney that if you want to report a criminal offense, I know how to navigate that system. If you want a lawsuit to hold institutions or individuals accountable, we can do that as well. If you want to go just through the campus process, you want your campus back, you want to be able to graduate and get to the next stage of your life, I know how to do that. So it ultimately has shaped everything that I do in my legal practice. And I'm very honored to say that yet another female crew member very recently came to me, similar situation as mine, and we successfully filed and opened a Title IX complaint against the UW-Madison because others have the courage too. And they now see the process and they now know there is someone who's going to help me through this. I'm not alone.
What about other protections? If you could help us understand how protections like the Clery Act against sexual assault and dating violence and domestic violence and stalking, how does that interact with Title IX protections?
Yes, I love talking about the Clery Act. It's so little known and yet it's so powerful, and it perfectly partners with Title IX. Title IX is attacking sexual discrimination, harassment, and violence as a civil right aspect, mm-hmm. and yet Clery is facing it as campus safety. So thinking about campus crimes, deterring those risks to students. So Clery, as you said, does protect a variety of forms of gender violence, stalking, dating violence, domestic violence, sexual assault. And together, they really ensure that anyone can come forward and report. Under Clery, you don't even have to be a student. So if you were assaulted by someone who's an employee, but you yourself don't go to UW, you can actually report under the Clery Act and let the school know, hey, someone that works for you is a safety risk. And there's a process that they are mandated to go through, just like we have under Title IX. And what Clery does that goes even further than Title IX is mandate prevention and response education for all incoming students and employees. And as part of that, really going into what are these crimes? What do they look like in daily life? We like to think that everyone will know if they're being abused and immediately be able to seek help. But some people are confused. Is this abuse? Is this wrong? Can I do something about it? Is it important enough? What happens if I come forward? And so all that training really is supposed to change the culture. And, you know, again, just tying it to my story, those changes of prevention education requirements, that's a directly from my advocacy. After what happened at UW-Madison, I partnered with national groups like the Clery Center for Security on Campus, and we changed the laws. We made sure that this would not happen to other survivors. And here we are at the 50th anniversary of Title IX saying we've made so much progress, but what's next? There's so much on the horizon.
Mm. Attorney Laura Dunn focuses on Title IX cases, campus sexual assault expert, worked with presidential administrations on Title IX regulation and guidance. Join in on what counts as sex discrimination, what schools are required to do, your experiences, most importantly, with campus policies or attitudes shifting, offices shifting. 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Laura Dunn. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with attorney Laura Dunn on this 50th anniversary of the landmark law Title IX. The U.S. Department of Education held a 5-day virtual public hearing last year to gather information for the purpose of improving enforcement of Title IX. Still waiting on what it holds for the Biden administration. Join in on what the future looks like. 800-642-1234. Victim rights attorney Laura Dunn with us for about 9 more minutes. Laura, earlier we said we're going to put a pin in LGBTQ rights, and I want to go there next. Title IX doesn't directly address race or gender identity or disabilities for that matter. Do you think that is a weakness of Title IX or missing protections?
So Title IX is actually modeled off of Title VI, which does have racial protections. So it may by itself only be about sex, but it's part of a tradition of civil rights legislation building off of racial protections and adding that for gender. And Section 504 protects disability, again, using almost the exact same language as Title VI. 6 and 9. So we do have all those protections. Unfortunately, they're just under different laws. So That's sometimes why you need assistance from an advocate or an attorney just to navigate. There are protections. The question is where and what.
Okay. And we've seen across the country and here in Wisconsin, we've seen anti-transgender legislation, seeking to ban transgender people from participating in sports, for instance. What are the gaps there in Title IX?
So as of 2020, the Bostick decision from the U.S. Supreme Court said, at least under Title VII, yet another civil rights protection that does target sex discrimination, but employment, that LGBTQ individuals are protected, that discriminating against them is a form of sex discrimination. So while we have not yet had that ruling explicitly under Title IX, that is the logical conclusion of that court case. So we are anticipating that the Biden administration, when it releases regulations, hopefully any day now, will have built-in protections for LGBTQ students. And you're correct that transgender individuals are being targeted largely for potential discrimination. That is a tough issue when we're dealing with athletics. How do we ensure a fair playing field for people regardless of their gender? But what I want to focus on is actually a protection that was so needed, that lacked for so many decades and really cost LGBTQ students their lives at some point. That's all this sexual harassment and discrimination and violence that they faced just for being who they are. That was prevalent, especially in K-12 schools, but of course still in colleges. And for years, no one was protecting these students. They would try to bring Title IX claims in several courts, including in the Fifth Circuit, would say they weren't protected. So they are now protected, and that is deeply important because we want everyone to have access to education.
How do you see the Office of Civil Rights doing in the Education Department overseeing compliance? How is it doing on enforcement?
It's a good question because so much has changed, right? We've gone through a pandemic.
Yes.
Under the Trump administration, bluntly, people were fleeing. I'm in Washington, D.C. People were leaving federal agencies, going elsewhere for their careers. So we are facing a situation where the federal government is reeling and not able, in my opinion, to focus on civil rights in the way that is absolutely necessary during these challenging times. But that is the challenge before us. How do we improve enforcement of all civil rights, and including Title IX, at these critical points when so many states are passing laws challenging different civil rights protections? So I would love to say that we are on top of it at the Office of Civil Rights, but unfortunately, I think they're very behind. You can still file complaints. Some complaints are being resolved. Some complaints from my clients are actively being investigated, and all of that's important, but the timeline is severely slowed compared to previous years.
People who are sexually assaulted can seek accountability through, as you know, the criminal justice system where you are, through campus policies and systems there. Can you walk us through what are the pros and cons of going either option?
Yes, absolutely. So anytime you experience sexual violence, whether it be in the workplace or on campus, you do have those three systems. You have criminal, if there is an offense committed. You have civil, if you want to have a lawsuit. And then there's kind of what would be the equivalent of HR, the campus level process. And all three are available to survivors. And you don't have to pick and choose. You could do one, two, all three. And I really always encourage survivors to report to law enforcement. A lot of people don't want to go to law enforcement. They worry it wasn't severe enough. They don't want to ruin the other person's life. But from my perspective, if this is a serial offender, we need to have a record. So even if you don't want to pursue it, having that person's name in a record helps us know, is this person doing it over and over? And if so, how can we make sure they're taken out of the community and rehabilitated before they're let back in? Civil is very challenging. You have to have the right kind of claims, the right kind of damages to really access that process because of the financial demands. So that leaves the campus process as the most accessible and honestly the most practical. Rather than waiting multiple years for the outcome of a lawsuit, you could get a protective order tomorrow. You could have an accommodation in your class today. You could be in a hearing in a few weeks, being able to testify against this individual that harmed you and hopefully getting a just outcome. So a lot of people choose that latter process, the campus process, and with great success. When I was a survivor, it was 50-50 whether anyone would do anything about your complaint. And since becoming an attorney, I have about a 78% success rate in making sure that these complaints turn into findings of responsibility.
Is that with working with the university or working through the court system? Because, you know, we've heard, too, that survivors have to show so much proof, so much documentation that what happened really happened, that it is such an uphill fight.
I definitely agree that the criminal process is still very challenging, right? Because the standard is beyond a reasonable doubt. So cases where there are prompt rape kits, immediate reports, potential witnesses, those are the strongest ones. Whereas at the campus level, you don't necessarily need additional proof. It is a credibility determination. But what I have found lately is that there's actually increasing evidence in these cases. It used to be he said, she said. Mm-hmm. But now with the advent of cell phones, there are images, there are photos, there is social media tweets, there's other people posting and being involved. It's surprising how thick my case files are and full of electronic evidence. So I have not found it challenging to get positive results in campus cases. The hardest part is a survivor being willing to come forward and access the process.
Oh, that's really interesting that you're seeing so much more evidence in your cases just because of our digital lives and social media and our phones.
Absolutely. A lot of times offenders think they can send a Snapchat to a survivor and, you know, admit what happened and that it will be destroyed. But there are ways to keep those Snapchats. And so we get a lot of admissions.
Laura Dunn, we have less than a minute left. Looking ahead at the next half century, what does it look like to you in your crystal ball?
I think it's going to continue to be a fight. We need everyone who cares about gender equality and access to education to put hands on the oar and row with us towards that future. But we want a situation where every single campus is safe. We don't want people to be terrified that they're going to be harassed or bullied or abused. We want students to go to a college and not risk being sexually assaulted within their first few weeks on campus, which is the highest risk period. We want schools that are no longer willing to protect offenders, but actually want to eradicate sexual violence through appropriate investigations and proceedings that ensure fairness and reliability in the results. And I don't think that's unattainable. I think that's very attainable, but it requires a cultural commitment. And if any state can do it, it's Wisconsin.
Laura Dunn, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Attorney Laura Dunn, victims' rights attorney, founding partner of a D.C.-based law firm aiming to advance and enforce victims' rights. Earlier, we talked with Judy Sweet, Title IX consultant, first woman to hold the post of NCAA president. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.